4321
BCFM 93.2.
So I believe it's a great fallacy to set out to brand those whom we disagree with as being evil people. The result of their actions we may perceive to be evil. We may perceive it to be bad, but I guarantee you those people don't see it that way. And when we present ourselves to them in that light, we're good and they're evil, do you think we have a chance of getting them to listen to us? Not on your life.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Russian GRU loitering around in The Hague, trying to undermine the investigation into Novichok. Also, apparently, Russian cyber attacks swirling around the world in many different countries. Canada, the UK, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Malaysia, Brazil, and the USA. Plus, the Batan Kali massacre of the 24 Malay insurgency suspects by the Scots Guards in 1948 is ruled out of time by the European Court of Human Rights. It's been compared to the My Lai massacre of 1968 by the United States forces in Vietnam. But let's get Batan Kali in perspective. My Lai villagers, 500 of them, were executed by American soldiers. And what about Mao's unspeakable Great Chinese Famine of 1958 to 1961, which I've only just found out about? Wonder if you've heard of it. Around 25 million Chinese starved to death. Tonight we hear from former SAS officer Barry Wynn, who fought in Malaysia, all about jungle warfare, and also his testimony he gave in defence of the families of those who lost their lives in Batan Kali as Britain was fighting a losing battle after World War II to keep the empire. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Mass media have turned a blind eye to. There's plenty of them. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. You can download it online now, though, at dialectradio.co.uk. This week we travel to Arnhem. Well, I travelled to Arnhem and some of the interviews I did over there to hear direct from the museum at the bridge. René van der Vlist is one of the guides. And for the full interview, you heard a bit of last week on this show with Rob van der Zon, where he speculates on who he believes the goddess is at the top of the obelisk at the Hartenstein Museum in Oosterbeek and why she's there. You can listen to Dialect here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. I think we'll start this week, Martin, with the alleged Russian hacking operation starting at the World Anti-Doping Agency in Canada announced this week.
Well, it seems to me that these so-called cyber attacks are not something that's happened recently. They've suddenly decided at this moment to accuse the Russians of cyber attacking these various institutions. And basically, I have to be honest with you, I don't believe a word they say. Basically, I think they're making it all up.
So you're saying that all of these, let me just run through them. Mm. In Canada, the World Anti-Doping Agency, the Sport and Anti-Doping Agencies, and a nuclear technology company in the United States, Sport and Anti-Doping Agencies in Brazil, the MH17 plane crash investigation in Malaysia, in Switzerland, the World Anti-Doping Agency and Chemical Weapons Watchdog, in the Netherlands, the Chemical Weapons Watchdog, which is where the report came out as well, about these two Russians hanging around this week. And also in Britain, the Foreign Office has been hacked, as has the Ministry of Defence.
Now, we're talking about hacking here. Now, what exactly has happened in each particular case? Have they introduced malware? They haven't said that. Now, GCHQ, just down the road here, they spend their whole day, there's a whole staff there, and they spend millions of pounds each year. What do you think they're doing? They're listening to foreign communications. Probably, in all the kind of organisations that you've just listed, the Russians supposedly hacking into. Now, if we're going to get rid of hacking, perhaps you should cancel GCHQ at all. We don't need GCHQ, do we? What does GCHQ do? GCHQ does hacking in those terms. Now, would it be surprising if the signals intelligence of the Russians was doing exactly the same thing as GCHQ, which is listening to what other people are talking about? Because that's what they do. Well, that's what they're there for.
The one thing I point out here is it's very easy to conceal the actual origin of a cyber attack by using proxy service in different countries. In fact, a whole series you can do. And there's been no proper evidence put forward with these accusations to show the exact how they know the Russians have done this. Now, of course, the Ministry of Defence and others will say, oh, well, we can't give you that evidence because that would give away our techniques for finding. So you basically just have to take it on trust.
Yeah, and why should we take it on trust? The Western intelligence services engage in information warfare. They've engaged in information warfare in the Ukraine, where evidence has come out through a court case. No court cases here, you'll notice, that the snipers, professional snipers that killed the pro-EU demonstrators in the run-up to the coup in Ukraine, because it was a coup, were actually orchestrated by the current regime.
But that's not a cyber attack, is
it? No, but that's a real court case where NATO intelligence services have been fingered for murdering 80 people.
Okay, but this
so why should we believe them when they say the Russians are cyber-attacking them? They need to be dismantled and put under democratic control.
It's not just Britain.
A bit like the old KGB or the Gestapo.
It's not just Britain that's saying it. It's also Australia and New Zealand.
But it's also
accusing Russian military intelligence of carrying out a worldwide campaign of malicious cyber attacks, including the hacking of the US Democratic National Committee in 2016. British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt said in a statement on Thursday this week that the country's National Cyber Security Centre, NCSC, had found, that's I suppose something to do with GCHQ, had found Russian GRU intelligence service operatives were behind cyber attacks believed to have cost the global economy millions of dollars. I don't see how many millions exactly. Australia,
don't suppose they know either.
Australia and New Zealand released similar statements alleging that their own intelligence agencies had also found evidence of Russian involvement, the same attacks on political, business, media and sporting institution. They're all members of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance, which also includes the US and Canada. The GRU's actions, they say, are reckless and indiscriminate. They try to undermine and interfere in elections in other countries. They're even prepared to damage Russian companies and Russian citizens, Jeremy Hunt said in a statement, and I'll put a link up to that CNN article on our show page.
All right, there's a whole list of allegations there, but let's just pick on the one substantial one, which is the so-called hacking of the Democratic National Committee. Now, we've got quite a lot of information about this, because in actual fact, the source of this information was WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks got hold of not a hack, but a leak from inside the Democratic National Committee, which looks as if it came from Seth Rich, who was one of the key IT people, who was subsequently murdered in very murky circumstances. And we've got overwhelming evidence from WikiLeaks, from Julian Assange, and from Craig Murray, who used to be British ambassador in Uzbekistan, who flew to Washington to collect the material, that leak came from inside the DNC. Now, what the FBI and the CIA have been claiming since then is that what the email showed, the leak or hack, whatever it was, showed, is that the whole of the primary process of the Democratic Party was rigged to prevent Bernie Sanders being the candidate for the Democrats in the election of that year. Now, in other words, if Sanders had been given a fair run and had got the nomination, he might well have beaten Trump, and we might be talking about President Sanders talking to President Putin and President Xi Jinping about world peace. But we're not, because the whole thing was rigged. And it wasn't rigged. Even the FBI and CIA admit that the Russians didn't rig the effects. What they say is this shows American democracy in a bad light, and therefore it must have been the Russians that got this information out there because they want to show America in a bad light. See the bad faith of that kind of argument. American democracy is hacked. It is rigged, but it's not rigged by the Russian secret services. It's rigged by the Western secret services. And all the other allegations that they make, do you know what? If you're in a court of law and you've shown to be lying about one thing,
None of your testimony about anything else is acceptable. Now, we know that the Western intelligence services engage in murder, hacking, and political subversion all over the world. We've got evidence from court cases going back decades. Now, that's not to say that the Russians are squeaky clean, but I don't believe a word that comes out of the Western intelligence services, including Australia and New Zealand. They're just puppets of the US, just as we are.
Some people disagree with you. One of them is the BBC's Anna Holligan, and she reports now on a reconnaissance dossier of Russians, which has been released by the Dutch government in The Hague this week.
We've just come out of a press conference, and this is the case file released by the Dutch intelligence service, but it reads more like a spy novel. We've been given a whole case file of information about how four alleged Russian GRU intelligence operatives arrived here in the Netherlands and conducted an operation in April 2018. I'll run you through it very quickly, chronologically. They've managed to collect taxi receipts that show a journey from the GRU barracks in Moscow to Moscow airport on the day these four men travelled to the Netherlands. They have photographs of them at Schiphol airport with a member of the Russian embassy. Then they have photographs seized from a laptop which show a reconnaissance mission around the headquarters of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog, which of course at the time was investigating the attack in Salisbury on Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia.
Well, these are allegations against... If you're carrying out cyber attacks, you don't actually send...
It's not just allegations, is it? She's presented, and the Dutch intelligence have presented with lots of evidence there.
No, what they've shown is that GRU... What they claim are GRU operatives went to Holland, and they've said, we've sent them back. Now, when you've sent them back, this is what they've done. They've not been put on trial. They've not been charged with anything. And I put it to the listeners. Intelligence services' main function is to tell lies. The Russian intelligence services no doubt tell strategic lies. So do ours. And they're working for a war with Russia because they want to build up their own spending on military expenditure. And there's a campaign of vilification against the Russian state, which is actually probably the most democratic state the Russians have ever had. They're pretty fed up with it, and I understand why.
Alexei Morenets, 41 years old, and Yevgeny Serebryakov, 37 years old, were described by the Dutch officials as cyber operators. Now, what were they doing? Hanging around the OCPW. OCPW, which is they're investigating their attack in Salisbury. Why are they hanging around over in the Hague?
If they're cyber operators, why do they get on a plane and fly to Holland anyway? You sit on a computer console like Brigade 77.
Okay, so what they're doing? What they're doing, Martin, is they're standing outside the OPCW, hacking into it physically from outside it.
Really? That's what they say, is it? Why should we believe them? Last week, we covered all the stuff around the Battle of Arnhem and the Dutch intelligence services being infiltrated by the Nazis and all the rest of it. Why should we... Just because they are the intelligence services, why are we supposed to believe everything they say? In actual fact, I would argue that intelligence services should be disbelieved unless they can show that they're telling the truth. That's got to be the rule.
The other side of this is, have they actually got any evidence that these guys committed any crimes while they were there?
Well, indeed.
Doesn't look as if they did.
No, that's why they're expelled instead of put on trial. So if they went on trial, they'd have to come up with the evidence,
wouldn't
they?
Let's have a listen to the second half of this clip from the BBC's Anna Holligan, where she talks about the discovery by the Dutch intelligence that these people had left a laptop there where they'd been doing Google searches. They had Wi-Fi records there too.
Now, they've even gathered together things like Google Maps, train tickets. He raised the question in this press conference, the Dutch intelligence officer, how do we know that these men weren't just on holiday here in The Hague? A nod, of course, to the Salisbury suspects' claim that they were simply tourists. And he said, well, look, they checked into the Marriott Hotel. They even took their litter away. That's not something that holidaymakers do. But beyond that, they had photographs of a number of mobile phones, a laptop which had a history of Google searches. Also, they checked into Wi-Fi hotspots. And I think beyond everything else, perhaps what's most surprising about this is that these men, who are allegedly members of President Putin's most elite military units, the GRU, could make what some people would characterize as such beginner's mistakes in leaving behind such a paper trail.
Well, I'm not sure if they did manage to get any information when they were there, but I can remember at the time, this is around about April this year, that the Russian media did announce that they believed that there were people working for the OPCW that thought that there was no Novichok used in Salisbury whatsoever, that actually, because no one had died and the symptoms weren't those of Novichok, because people die when they get Novichok poisoning, that actually the OPCW, some people within that organisation were saying that it was much more likely to be this BZ nerve gas, which is actually a way of disabling troops, but it doesn't kill them. So it's potentially these guys that realised that there was some dissent going on within the OPCW office. So they weren't necessarily there to, to do anything malicious. And I find it rather strange that all of the implications of these are that there was some sort of malice involved, and this is yet more evidence of Russian malice to the global system.
We've now reached a situation where the Russians are accused of just about anything you can think of. Yeah, I mean, as we discussed the other week, the so-called Skripal murderers spent the night before their murder getting stoned and having noisy sex with prostitutes in their hotel, which of course you would do if you were a GRU operative. I sent you that article like this week, or you sent it to me, of an Israeli assassin, and of course they admitted that they've carried out 2,500 murders in the last
2,700
in the last decade, yeah. And they said, well, that's not how you do it at all. And he gave and we can perhaps put the link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and people can read what an Israeli intelligence officer who's been involved in assassinations says about all of this. None of this adds up. That's not how you do assassinations at all. And of course, most of the public haven't got a clue about this.
Well, we're definitely
just
we'll
Russians,
that,
Novichok, war. Weapons.
We'll definitely do that. We'll put a link up to our show page about that. But there is actually on thisweek.org.uk, but there is another aspect to all of this. The cyber attacks particularly. I can remember we were discussing this end of last year, beginning of this year, that the military doctrine was that if NATO countries were attacked by a cyber attack, that this gave the military the option to retaliate with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, that is... NATO doctrine has always never been to say that we wouldn't use nuclear weapons first. Most people don't realise it, but that's the doctrine. And that's supposed to keep the other side on edge. And, of course, it does keep them on edge and makes us all less safe than we'd otherwise be. But the idea that... this whole idea of cyber attacks is totally hyped. Yeah, the idea that elections can be hacked. Well, they can't be hacked if you're using paper ballots. It's only if you're using electronic equipment that they can be hacked. And so what they do is they introduce electronic equipment and then scream as if they're being hacked. And of course, the elections are hacked, but they aren't being hacked by the Russians. They're being hacked by our own intelligence services. Our own intelligence services are far more powerful than people realise. They basically run the show. The politicians are just the front people. And that's been going on for donkey's years. Everybody in Russia knows that this is the way the real world works, because they lived in a totalitarian state. In the West, people would presume that the intelligence services are just there to protect us, which is absolutely absurd when you look at the history of their actual behaviour.
Okay. Now, the Israeli you were talking about is a guy called Alexander Brass, and he says it's absolutely absurd, the story that we're being spun about what happened in Salisbury. He said in any operation if you wanted to eliminate someone, it's a very serious operation. It's prepared for a very long time in advance. You're talking about dozens of employees. He said, isn't in the operation a technical support group, a logistic group, a cover group, an external surveillance group, and a group of performers are involved. The performers themselves appear at the very last moment. They do not go anywhere. They don't appear on any cameras. They don't go on public transport. They move on rented cars, which they do not rent themselves. And the more, they will not stop in hotels either, they stay in safe houses provided by the logistics group, another group in such an operation. Such groups do not come under the passport of their country or go to the embassy for obtaining any visas or leaving any fingerprints.
Yeah, well, that's a professional intelligence officer telling you how real hits are carried out. And, of course, the Israelis have admitted that they've carried out 2,700 such hits in the last... They're our allies, by the way. 2,700... All illegal, of course. Murdering people's illegal.
So what he's said is... this is Alexander Brass. He said it was a rough provocation by the British Special Services. In my opinion, he says this is obvious.
Well, he's a professional intelligence officer and he knows what he's talking about. It's a provocation by the British. Now, if the British are engaged in provocations in Salisbury, perhaps they're also engaged in provocations in Amsterdam.
I haven't seen
and Anna, provocations around
Martin,
the world.
I haven't seen Anna Holligan on the BBC either quoting him or interviewing him.
No, because basically they don't do their jobs properly, these people, and they're well paid for not doing them properly.
So let's also have a look at the more general picture here by dipping in again to Theresa May's speech at the Conservative Party conference, where she also talks about the central dangerous role of Russia in Britain's threat as a threat to Britain's national security. She sees Putin as a key figure there.
And that's what this job is all about, taking the big decisions and doing so in the national interest. That is never more true than when our national security is threatened. Those are the times when I feel most keenly the responsibilities of my office. When I have to ask our brave servicemen and women to put themselves in harm's way, to protect our citizens, to support our allies as we would expect them to support us, to uphold the international rules on which our security depends. Like when the Syrian regime attacked Douma with chemical weapons, killing innocent men, women and children, we joined with our friends to send a message that the use of chemical weapons will never be tolerated. I took the decision to send RAF jets to strike against Assad's chemical weapons facilities. As Prime Minister, I had to make the call and then be held to account for it. The same was true when Russia launched a chemical attack on the streets of the United Kingdom. I took the decision to expel 23 Russian diplomats who were undeclared intelligence officers. Our allies joined us in degrading Russia's intelligence network. In Parliament, I received almost universal support. From the SNP to the Liberal Democrats and the Labour backbenches, there was just one dissenting voice, Jeremy Corbyn, dismissing the findings of our security services, suggesting that the country responsible for the attack should double-check the findings of our chemical weapons scientists, refusing to lay the blame squarely where it belonged. Just imagine if he were Prime Minister. He says Britain should disarm herself in the hope others follow suit. I say no, we must keep our defences strong to keep our country safe. He says a strong NATO simply provokes Russia. I say no, it is the guarantor of our freedom and security. He poses as a humanitarian, but he says that military action to save lives is only justified with the approval of the Security Council, effectively giving Russia a veto. I say no. We cannot outsource our conscience to the Kremlin.
Crikey, that was a long bit of applause there. We can't outsource our conscience to the Kremlin. She's saying actually there shouldn't be a veto for Russia at the UN Security Council.
Yeah, well, that's what the British have been pushing for, to basically change the international architecture. So modern democratic Russia, it's what the most democratic government it's ever had, is to be excluded from the Security Council on the say-so of Great Britain. And of course, you talked there about the chemical weapons attack in Douma. There's not a shred of evidence that there was a chemical weapons attack. There have been chemical weapons in the attacks in the past. They're
well, she's been just watching the BBC and well, seeing well, what's on the news, hasn't she?
Also, she's just been listening to her intelligence service. She's always been very close to the intelligence services, Theresa May. She's very much their puppet. And, of course, we then bombed, with no Security Council resolution, Britain, France and the US bombed Syria. They were lucky that they didn't fire back, because under international law, they've got the absolute right to fire back, and they should have actually... If the Russians could have decided, right, we're going to hit Akrotiri in Cyprus. Let me just finish, Tony. Akrotiri in Cyprus shouldn't even be there, because the people of Cyprus don't want a British base there. They don't. People of Bahrain don't want a base there either. So all of this old talk about NATO and all the rest of it, the world has moved on.
Well, she's saying...
The world has moved on, and we're
saying,
on the brink of World War
Martin,
III,
what
and we don't
saying,
need that kind of
what
talk.
What she's
frankly.
Saying is we are not outsourcing our conscience to Russia at the UN Security Council. We are not going to accept their veto.
No, well, then why should they accept the US veto on Israel's misbehaviour? The Russians could say, no, we're not accepting your veto on... Because, of course, when the Israelis do anything wrong, the US vetoes it. And the Russians could say, well, we're not going to accept an American veto. So we are going to strike Israel.
Well, quietly.
Why not?
Quietly in the
back. They're very violent. Maybe the only message... I'm not a pacifist, Tony.
Quietly.
Maybe people who go to war have got to accept the consequences of people fighting
quietly
back.
In the background, the Chinese at the UN Security Council are being unscrutable, aren't they? They're saying, well, what's going on here? Well, and what is their attitude to international law, then? If Britain's attitude is, well, we're just going to disregard the UN Security Council now.
Well, the attitude will be, if the UN Security Council doesn't mean anything, then we don't have to take any notice of the UN Security Council, do we? If our veto doesn't mean anything in it, then maybe we're going to come to it and we'll carry on voting against you. But as international law now stands, the intervention in Yugoslavia over Kosovo was illegal. Now, there's been the invasion of Iraq was illegal. Now, when she talks about taking responsibility, if a major war had broken out because of her decision to put RAF Akrotiri into bombing mode on Syria, if the Syrians and the Russians had fought back, for example, by shooting at Akrotiri and killing hundreds of RAF service personnel, and then it turned into a major war, like the war in Iraq, which has killed a million people. And has Tony Blair been sent to The Hague for that? And, of course, our allies, the US, have just said we're not interested in international law, not at The Hague, not at the UN. We don't do international law. And what I'd say to Theresa May is, you can keep your conscience, because your conscience really needs to be examined about what you've been doing. Never mind what the Russians have been doing, what you've been doing.
Well, what about the cladding gurus at Grenfell Tower? Have any of those been even arrested?
Well, we're talking geopolitics now.
What I'm saying is that's not just in geopolitics terms. No. It's also domestic, isn't it?
Well, of course, in actual fact, but what really sickens me about Theresa May's speech there is the school marmish attitude towards everybody else in the world. We are right. We are the British. We know who we are, and we're the best in the world. And everybody else, they really got to listen to us, because we know we never get anything wrong, and we're completely in the right, and they're completely in the wrong.
Yeah, after 2003, and after the Iraq War.
Yeah, yeah. The France and Germany voted against in the UN Security Council, including every other Commonwealth country apart from Australia. But we ignored all of that, and we went to war. And we said at the time, this is going to be a disaster. Oh, and it'll take a few weeks. It'll all be sorted out. We're years later now, and it hasn't been sorted out or anything like sorted out. In fact, the war's spread and grown. And of course, if she carries on talking like that, we really could have a proper, real big Middle East war with loads of people killed. And will she take responsibility for that and go to The Hague? I wonder. I doubt it.
On antiwar.com today, Associated Press are saying that the US military program, a US military program, could be seen as a bioweapon. A research arm of the US military is exploring the possibility of deploying insects to make plants more resilient by altering their genes. But some experts say the work is seen as a potential biological weapon. As an opinion paper published on Thursday in the journal Science, the authors say the US needs to provide greater justification for peacetime purpose of its Insect Allies project to avoid being perceived as a hostile to other countries. Other experts expressed ethical and security concerns with the research, which seeks to transmit protective traits to crops already growing in the field. Now, bioweapons, is that... I mean, surely all they're trying to do here, this is, you know, kind of jumping ahead, isn't it? All they're trying to do here in the US is to do some sort of basic bits of genetic engineering to allow things like less aphids on plants. But why might some people see that as a bioweapon?
Well, there are bioweapons out there, and there are chemical weapons out there, like Agent Orange, which was sprayed all over Vietnam. Did anybody in America go to court for any or punished for any of that? When Fallujah was attacked by Mad Dog Mattis, they used white phosphorus. The Israelis used white phosphorus in Gaza. So we can use chemical weapons, but you can't. And of course, in actual fact, the Russians don't use chemical weapons in general. They dismantled their version of Porton Down in the 1990s in Uzbekistan when Craig Murray was our ambassador over there. And in actual fact, this talk of chemical weapons is just trying to blacken and the whole chemical weapons are terrible, but of course the weaponry supply to the jihadis inside Syria, which has killed thousands and thousands of people, and the SAS are still there training people to do it, that's okay.
In the US,
ordinary bullets are all right, US, chemical weapons we've got to worry
about. In the US as well yesterday, Pentagon is claiming near limitless power to conduct unauthorised strikes. Officials are arguing collective self-defence is being too broadly interpreted. Senators are pushing for clarification from the Pentagon about their interpretation of the concept of collective self-defence, in inverted commas, under which the US military claims near limitless powers to conduct unilateral strikes on enemies not authorised by Congress or the UN. The expansion of the notion that military forces have the right to self-defence if they're attacked was expanded to a collective right which allows the US to intervene when anyone the Pentagon identifies as a partner is either under attack or faces a conceivable threat from someone else. Pentagon's affirmed in recent correspondence with Senator Kaine, K-A-I-N-E, that this is how they view things, and that moreover it's not typically limited to particular groups or individuals committing a hostile act or demonstrating hostile intent. This means, in effect, they can attack the targets Congress has never authorised them, as long as they select some partner that could benefit from that attack.
Well, the original Constitution of the United States was pretty clear that Congress was the only body empowered to declare war. And of course what's happened is the so-called imperial presidency has gradually taken over that function. It was never supposed to be the function of the president to declare war, but of course it's not even the president who runs things in the US, it's the Pentagon. And dare I say it, it's not even Theresa May who runs things in this country.
Also,
it's the intelligence service and the military working for the Americans.
Well, she certainly does seem to be just sitting there reading a script, doesn't she? Doesn't sound like there's a lot of depth.
Let's get real.
She's saying Mattis over in the US says that America is to respond to blatant Russian violation of arms treaties. He says the US is reviewing options to respond diplomatically or militarily. Just days after the US Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchinson threatened to start a war against Russia by preemptively destroying a certain type of Russian missiles over a perceived violation of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, Defense Secretary James Mattis is continuing the saber-rattling. He's claimed Russia is in blatant violation of the INF and that the US will not allow the cavalier disregard to continue. He says the US is reviewing a series of potential diplomatic and military options to be taken about it and that non-acting is untenable. Unlike Hutchinson, whose comments gave the impression that a major war was imminent, Mattis was very cautious about not providing any specifics, saying he would not get into details about what sort of response the US would be likely to take. The INF treaty issue has been going on for years, with the US objecting to a certain Russian test. Russia insists that missiles in no way violate the INF. There appears to have been little attempt to discuss the matter at all between the two countries. So this is another bit of saber rattling. But also, the US would, this is also from antiwar.com, US would preemptively destroy Russian warheads, an envoy warns. The US ambassador to NATO, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, threatened war against Russia in comments on Tuesday. So this is actually part of that same story, the previous bit, saying the US was, sorry for doing them in the reverse order, was prepared to preemptively take out Russian missiles that the US objects to Russia having. So this is quite serious if NATO are actually threatening to strike Russian forces. I mean, I don't think the Americans would like it very much if it was the other way around.
Well, the problem with saying things like that is the Russian generals might come to the conclusion that that's exactly what they've got to do, because they've got to get their retaliation in first. And if you think about it, they've been putting these missiles, anti-ballistic missiles, into Romania and Poland, which actually are right on the Russian border. So they could carry out a preemptive strike to decapitate Moscow in the hopes that the button wouldn't be pressed and they wouldn't fire back. Now, just imagine what would happen if the Russians were to put in the missiles that they've got inside Russia in Cuba. We don't have to ask. We know what happened. Now, the Russians are getting pretty fed up of NATO pushing these missiles right in their face.
And when they put, when they create countermeasures, they're then accused of breaking the INF. Now, the INF treaty was signed between Gorbachev and Reagan in the 80s, and basically it took these short-range missiles out of the equation and got rid of anti-ballistic missiles so that nobody could do a first strike. That's all been ripped up unilaterally by the US. The US is spoiling for a fight with Russia. The Russians are trying to avoid it, and they're getting pretty fed up with the attitude. But if we do trip over, They won't just get a pushover for obvious things that might happen if there's a war in Syria. Is everybody in Akrotiria better get their tin hats on? Because if I was the Russian commanders, I would just incinerate that base. Kill everybody in it.
Love Bristol. Love. BCFM. 93.2.
Well, over to Malaysia now, or as it used to be called, Malaya. We are looking this week at the Batang Kali massacre. That's the European court has rejected a call for a probe into this massacre of 24 Malaysia rubber plantation workers by British troops in 1948, saying it came too late. Relatives of the workers waged a decades-long fight for an inquiry into the massacre, which occurred on the 12th of December 1948, during what's known as the Malay Emergency, when Commonwealth forces fought a communist-inspired revolt in what was then a British colony. But the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, eastern France this week, which hears complaints about violations of the European Convention, rejected the position petition as inadmissible. Now, I find this fascinating, particularly because it was compared to the My Lai massacre, which was far, far worse. 500 were killed there by American troops in Vietnam. And also, Martin, about I thought it was an opportunity to bring up this very little known about, little talked about famine, where 25 million Chinese starved to death between 1958 and 1961, which is hardly mentioned.
Well, the Great Leap Forward is well known to those who are students of Chinese history.
It wasn't really a Great Leap Forward.
It wasn't a Great Leap Forward. It was a disastrous policy pursued by Mao to try and industrialise in one go. And you know, there's all sorts of stupidities associated with that era in Chinese politics.
So what caused the famine?
Well, what caused the famine is they'd collectivised the peasantry, much against their will. And then, at first, the land reforms that they brought in were popular because they're basically giving people the land. Then they took it back, took it off everybody. And then they were then told to try and, everybody was going to try and produce steel in backyard furnaces, which was just totally unviable, magical thinking. And of course, eventually, of course, the food production collapsed and then all these people died, which is pretty silly. But you know, that's when you talk about numbers of people dying in Chinese famines. You know, there were famines in the 19th century when the British were running the show, basically the Taiping Rebellion and all the rest of it. And millions of people do die in China because there are millions of them. You know, anything that goes wrong in China has huge impact because there's so many Chinese. You know, so a lot of them die if they
there's
get things wrong.
Also, a massive famine in Ukraine, wasn't there?
In the 30s,
in the 1930s. Anyway, famines aside, let's go back to Malaysia, or Malaya as it was then, and hear from former SAS officer Barry Wynne, who he's been on the show before once or twice, but he was actually over there, and he I thought was a really wonderful thing, which is he stood alongside the villagers and said, actually, I think we did the wrong thing here, even though I think he was in the Devon Regiment, not in the Scots Guards, who were involved in this massacre. And he explains what it was like as a young man being sent over just after the Second World War over to Southeast Asia.
My name is Barry Wynne. I'm talking about an incident which took place in 1948. At that time, the British Army became involved in the first anti-colonial war after the Second World War. And that took place in the jungles and the country of Malaysia. It was estimated that during the late 40s, more than 7,000 battle-hardened communist guerrillas were active all over Malaya, killing some 3,000 unarmed citizens and 2,000 police and soldiers. I was 18 at the time, and this incident, which is called the Batang Kali Massacre, took place in December 1948. I had just been trained by Special Forces Infantry training group in Northern Ireland, taken a year, and I was on my way to Hong Kong, where my regiment, the 1st Battalion of the Devon Regiment, was then situated, having been transferred from Burma, where they fought. So I, newly commissioned, was on a troop ship bound for Hong Kong, and when we were going through the Suez Canal, we were suddenly informed, in true British Army fashion, that we were not going to Hong Kong, that the regiment in Hong Kong was now on its way to Singapore, and that I was to get off at Singapore and be prepared for immediate action. In fact, this coming Christmas will be the 70th anniversary of the Batankali massacre. I was, on the days that this took place, myself in the jungle with my troops fighting this very difficult battle. The fact was that in those days, the British Army had virtually been disbanded after the Second World War, and we were young conscripts, and I was, as I say, 18 at the time. When we arrived in Singapore, to my absolute amazement, my company commander told me we're doing a shore landing on an island called Paula Taikong in 2 days' time from invasion barges. You can imagine that I only just met my own troops. We were told that the Mao communist guerrillas were already occupying this island, and of course it was all panic stations at that time because of the way the Japanese had taken the Malaysian Peninsula, and that we were immediately sent in to quell this apparent invasion. The Chinese communists under Mao Zedong were in fact fighting the Japanese during the war. They were fighting the Japanese, and we armed the Chinese communist guerrillas who were operating all over Malaya. And of course, when the atom bomb was dropped on Japan, suddenly we found that the Allies, that's the Chinese communists, managed to steal all the weaponry we had supplied to them from Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, and the Cocos Islands, and they took up arms against us. So we suddenly were trying to, what we thought at the time, was hold the British Empire together. Within weeks, I and my platoon were up country in one of the worst communist-dominated areas, which was North Johor. We were badly armed. We had no jungle boots, and we were trying to put down this insurrection. It took 12 years before this was completed, about the same time as the British Army was in Afghanistan. But we, the British, sustained more casualties in Malaysia than did the British Army in Afghanistan. But nobody today knows anything about it. And this actually took place even 2 years before the Korean conflict.
So Barry Wynn was doing this jungle warfare. It was really, I suppose, an attempt to save face.
We were trying to put down this insurrection. We were searching villages. And, of course, in these villages, you had young men who, during the day, were rubber tappers, and at night time got into their uniforms and black dress and attacked the mining operations, the rubber plantations, and created hell on earth. But they were very, very difficult to distinguish. So during the day, you go, say, into the rice fields, and there'd be young men doing their work in the paddy fields, and you could not distinguish them. I mean, you didn't know whether they were suspects or not. And their tactics at the time were really hit and run. So they had jungle camps into which they'd put all the armory that we had sent them to fight the Japanese, which they had filched from the British Army, and they came out of these camps in the jungle or from the villages and the rice fields and attacked the British. So it was a kind of a hit-and-run situation, and we very seldom saw them. They sniped, killed a couple of troops, and disappeared. And you know, it was extremely difficult, so we were dealing with ambushes. And to give you an idea, I was shot at, on one occasion, in 24 hours, three times at less than 10 paces, which was fairly exhilarating. They weren't very good shots, fortunately. In fact, one of the incidents, I was shot at by a Chinese policeman. At another one, I had entered the bandit camp. I, in fact, was the leading man on the patrol, and as we were going, I didn't know I was about to enter a bandit camp. It was the first bandit camp that my regiment found, and the man in front of me, who was an ex-para, I suddenly saw him tense, and that second, by now we'd become very experienced jungle fighters, when I saw him tense, I hurled myself to the ground, and the machine guns just simply zipped across my head for about maybe half a minute, and the leaves were coming down like blossom blown in the wind, so they weren't very good shots, and that was the kind of situation that we faced. They were hit for a few minutes and then disappear. In fact, on that occasion, I never saw who it was that was shooting. The jungle is so thick that 2 feet in front of me, you can't see anything. And true to our training and what I tried to instill into my men, never fire until you see who the hell you're firing at. And in fact, I never even pulled the trigger. Now, after about a minute or 2 minutes of very, very considerable automatic fire, they suddenly stopped and disappeared. Never saw them, but I did find their camp. And when reinforcements arrived the following morning, we went in and destroyed it. That was the kind of thing. It was very, very, very difficult. And the morale of our men, which was generally pretty high, but they were very exasperated because you couldn't hit back, because you never saw them.
Now, when you got a flavour of what jungle warfare was like, here Barry talks about the actual massacre itself.
It was really a straightforward thing. You're to go to this village, surround it, find all the people in it, especially the young men, and the police will come and interrogate. That was basically the instruction. But on this occasion, this patrol was not led by officers who were really much better trained, to be honest with you, to understand all the implications. It doesn't mean that the sergeants weren't excellent, and they were excellent and well trained, and I was trained by the Brigade of Guards, and you couldn't want a better disciplined lot of men anywhere in the world. So, but they are usually very tall. The jungle is very dense. They had not been trained in jungle warfare, and they were being shot at. And in fact, on one occasion, I remember, when some of them were bathing in the river, which they shouldn't have been, they were badly shot up, and 3 of them were killed. So that soon gets around. So this patrol was sent to surround the village, see if there were any people, because there'd been a lot of action in the area, to see if there were any young men there, and if they were, to separate them from the women and the children, put them in a hut for the night, and then they would be interrogated by the civil police. That was the brief. But what actually happened, there are two distinct stories, and I'll try and give it to you. It is claimed that the men were Chinese terrorists and were gunned down trying to escape. This version was accepted by the British authorities, which stated 2 weeks after the incident, after careful consideration of the evidence and a personal visit to where where the incident occurred, the Attorney General is satisfied that the suspects would have made good their escape had the security forces not opened fire. It is not proposed to take any further action in this incident. I had just come back from the jungle, and this was reported in the Straits Times, and after I had given a debrief to my company commander, he pushed over a copy of the Straits Times, I think it was dated the 12th of December 1948, and he said, look at this, we've just managed to kill 24 of these blasted people. And I said, well, I wish I could find 24 of them to kill. We've never seen them even. He said then, Barry, words are getting around that they weren't armed. And that was the beginning. And that story has continued over 70 years. And when Dennis Healy decided that there should be an investigation, and Scotland Yard were brought into it, because one or two of these Scottish ex-soldiers now living in their civilian life, 20 or 30 years later, had let it be known the 24 victims were unarmed. And they signed witness confessions about this. And therefore, it's always been thought to be a cover-up situation.
Well, that's Barry Wynn there. And his attitude, Martin, is it's time to draw a line under this, but there would be no harm at all for the British actually apologising, since it was pretty clear that these guys were unarmed when they were shot.
Yeah, it's a sad story, isn't it? And, of course, the ultimate question you have to ask yourself is, should Britain run Malaysia? Or should the Malaysians run Malaysia?
Or should the Chinese at the time? That was the other.
There's probably a big Chinese population in Malaysia. They're not the majority, and there's tension between the Chinese and the Malays. Nevertheless, the British have really no right to be in Malaysia in the first place, and that's one of the problems, isn't it?
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Finally, a story that you just pointed out to me, Martin, which I'd managed to miss. Two members of the famous Lopresti ice cream family facing modern slavery charges. Sam Lopresti, this is the family of the Bristol... not Bristol North West, is it? It's Bradley Stoke and Filton, Conservative MP and Freemason, Jack Lopresti. Two members of the famous family charged with modern slavery offences and also requiring a person to perform forced labour. In addition, Sam Lopresti has been charged with assault, occasioning actual bodily harm.
Well, I mean, it's innocent till proved guilty, but it's an interesting development, isn't it?
Finally this week, there's an event tomorrow starting at midday at the Ark Bar on Broad Street, which is being organised by a group called Windows on the World. They're calling it The Bigger Picture. I've had a chat to Mark Windows, who's going to be one of the people down there. Also, Piers Corbyn, the brother of the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, and one or two other people, really talking about how our local government and our central government is being corporatised, privatised quietly behind the scenes. So let's have a listen to him now.
If you want to control and manage resources and population, you need a plan. And that plan is now global and has been for quite a long time. And for instance, people can look at things like the Habitat conferences every year, every 2 years actually, they're biennial now. But they dictate housing policy. Now, all this high density housing that's being introduced into areas. I mean, I've seen London and areas of London, so-called regeneration areas, have changed completely within 3 years. They've changed out of all recognition to what they were. And say I lived in a borough called Waltham Forest. It didn't change for 25 years. How come in 3 years all the infrastructure changed? 70 roads closed with no public consultation, people saying we didn't vote for this, and nobody seems to be able to know where it came from or what can be done about it. So basically, we're giving people the tools to look at this, and it's not actually that complicated. And once you look at it as a system, it makes complete sense. But if you can't see it as for what it is, then it's incredibly difficult to understand and it starts to look a bit mind-blowing. And that's what I want to do with this talk. We've got all the quotes and all of the documents that people can look at. And we've now got people all over the country sending us documents which prove that this is what's going on in local councils. So councils are now becoming these mega regions. In other words, lots of local authorities are joining together. Just look that up. What this is about is public consultation is being removed. And that's what these talks are about. And basically what you can do to take back some kind of power locally. And we are actually having some success with this.
Where and when can people see what you're up to, Mark?
Well, we're at the ARC Centre in Bristol on Saturday, the 6th of October. And it's from midday. There's going to be myself and Piers Corbyn. We talk about the housing, the regeneration that's going on all over the country, the background to that. And then we go into the bigger picture of the global action plan, which is affecting everybody locally. And we have Sandy Adams as well talking about the background and the implementation of Agenda 21. And all this is actually from a perspective of people who've done lots of research on it. So we've actually got the documentation and everything. So, yeah, we're in Bristol on Saturday. It's windowsontheworld.net. We're going to be there all day from 12 a.m.
And if no one does anything, what's Bristol going to look like in 20 years' time?
Well, that's a really good question, because with the rollout of 5G and what's going on with the Internet of Things, my word would probably be dystopia, because that's what I see being rolled out now. The way places are changing, especially in cities, is, to me, draconian. It's a corporate takeover of everything. So I would say that we're just going to see very sterile places with no individuality and a completely controlled and managed population with no private transport and being put into these high density housing places where people are monitored and surveilled 24 hours a day.
Okay, that's all for this. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join Mohammed after this. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.